Okay, welcome to our final week of Tuesday Bible study. Okay, on Sunday I was sitting out there and there was a super annoying hum coming from these things. Do you guys hear that? It sounds better in here. On Sunday it was going to make me homicidal, but I endured it. I endured it with patience, like Peter tells me to. So if you don't hear it, then I'm not going to worry about it, because I don't hear it now either. They must have fixed it. Or it was a fluke. All right, let's jump right into the final chapter of the first epistle of Peter. Verse 1. Now, as an elder myself and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as one who shares in the glory to be revealed. Well, we'll do 1 and 2 because it's one sentence. I exhort the elders among you to tend the flock of God that is in your charge, exercising the oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you do it, not for sordid gain, but eagerly. In chapter 5, Peter is going to sum up. This is the perfect place to end. That's why it's at the end of the epistle. Peter is going to sum up everything else that we've been talking about throughout this whole chapter. This first part of chapter 5 is addressed to leaders in the church. It is one of the texts that is used for ordination. And so Father Brian preached on this passage at my ordination, so I have a special fondness for it. But it also applies to the entire church of God. So first of all, notice that this chapter 5, verse 1, this is the first time that the author of the letter to Peter, of letter of Peter, has spoken in the first person since that very opening session, that very opening line, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. He hasn't mentioned himself at all through the course of the entire letter until now. And now he is giving three sources of his authority. Basically, I have told you all of this. I've given you lots of instruction, lots of insight. And here is how you know you can trust me. First, he says, as an elder myself. Literally, it's kind of redundant in English, but not in Greek. As a co-elder myself. As a co-laborer, a co-elder with the rest of you. He is one who is witness to the sufferings of Christ and one who shares in the glory to be revealed. So let's unpack each of these. He is an elder himself. The word elder, it's a compound verb, co-elder. The elder, not verb, word. The elder part is presbyteros. This is a word that the church borrows from the Septuagint, used to describe leaders, elders in the Jewish community. As an elder myself, it is, of course, where our term, the presbyterate, presbyters, what we in our tradition call priests, come from. So our tradition of having bishops, presbyters, and deacons is drawn out of these Greek words, episkopos, presbyteros, and I can't remember the noun form for deacons. However, this is likely not, Peter is likely not addressing, you know, kind of, don't think of like pastor or priest as a job description, but those who are leading the community. The elders, those who are looked up to, who are really, you know, it's like on an airplane when the turbulence, so you know how like stuff has been falling off of planes lately? Have you seen this in the news? And my favorite one I saw was like the people were sitting in the plane and they looked out the window and the wing was on fire. The engine was on fire. And they like told the, you know, flight attendant, whatever. They're like, I don't think that's supposed to happen. So then the pilot comes out of the cockpit and like comes down the aisle and he like leans over, you know, probably way too close to people because plane, and he looks out the window. He gets up and he goes back to the cockpit. Yeah, we're gonna be making an emergency landing for Oh man, you see a pilot come out of the cockpit to go over and look out the window. Like, then I start getting nervous, right? So this is the thing on planes, is like, when there's turbulence and things are, you know, I'm a little bit of a nervous flyer, and when things are like really rocky, if you look at the flight attendant and she's still like standing there pouring someone a Diet Coke, you're like, okay, we're probably not gonna crash. Because it seems like if we were gonna crash, she'd go ahead and sit down. So people look to their leaders to kind of hold the moral and emotional center. So Peter has given this church a lot of instruction, primarily instruction about how to maintain their Christian charity, their Christian composure, their Christian patience, their Christian humility, how to stay virtuous even when they're suffering. Well, it's one thing to hear a letter from some guy in Rome. It's another thing to see your community leader do that. So that's why he's writing to the elders. So in this way, everyone here is an elder. You all have people who look up to you. Family members, people in the parish, people in your workplace. And so how can you hold that moral center using that instruction that Peter has given? Notice too, he's identifying with the people he's addressing. Remember, sympathy, coming alongside as a fellow elder, as a co-elder, as one who has to do the same things you have to do. Next, a witness to the sufferings of Christ. So this word witness, martys, is the Greek. There's several meanings to this word in Scripture. There is one who sees something as an eyewitness, specifically so that they can attest to it in trial. We still use this sort of word, like, well, were there any witnesses to the accident? Right? Did anyone see what happened so that they can give a testimony in a trial? It is, there is one who gives a testimony or attestation on behalf of something, whether or not they're an eyewitness. So, you know, I've used this example before. I've never seen my husband's birth certificate. But if someone says, is this your husband? I can say, yes, this is Joshua, my husband. I'm not an eyewitness. I certainly wasn't an eyewitness to his birth. That would be oogie for so many reasons. Not least of which is that he's 2 years older than me. So that would be confusing. I certainly wasn't an eyewitness, but I can say, yeah, this is Joshua and this is his mother and I'm his wife, right? I can give a testimony to that. And then finally, in the Christian sense, there is this martys witness, martyreia, one who gives a testimony by giving up his life, one who is willing to die for Christ as a witness to the gospel. So which one is Peter using here when he says, I'm a witness to the sufferings of Christ? It is unlikely to be the first. Peter in the Gospels is not an eyewitness to the sufferings of Christ. He leaves, remember? Peter flees. Even in John, when some disciples follow him to the cross, you know, in most of the Gospels, Jesus dies alone. Only in John are there other apostles there, his mother and the beloved disciple. Peter leaves. So Peter is not a witness to Christ's suffering with his eyes, even if the Apostle Peter wrote this letter, or if he's writing as the voice of the Apostle Peter. It is likely that he is speaking as one who attests to something. This is similar to how Peter in Acts talks about being a witness to the suffering and resurrection of Jesus. For example, in Acts 2:32, he says, "This Jesus God raised up, and of that, all of us are witnesses." that all of us can give testimony to the fact that God raised Jesus from the dead, even though they didn't see it with their eyes. And there's another reason to think that this is what Peter is saying. Remember 1 Peter chapter 1, way back in the beginning, verse 8. He says, although you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you have believed in him and rejoice with indescribable and glorious joy. The whole point, especially of like last Sunday's gospel reading from John, is that those who have not seen Christ's earthly body with their eyes can still be witnesses to his suffering and resurrection. So Peter is a witness, as all of us are called to be. Finally, he says he is one who shares in the glory to be revealed. As we've seen over and over again in this letter, Peter never loses sight of this eschatological, this full consummation of what in the Christian tradition we call the parousia, the return of Jesus Christ as judge in the last day. And so for Peter, of course, this is the moment when the glory of God will be revealed fully. He is one who shares in the glory to be revealed. And who does he share it with? Everyone else in the church, the churches to whom he's writing. Verse 2, he says, now that he's given his authority, he says to the elders, tend the flock of God in your charge. The image of a shepherd with a flock is found in both the Old and the New Testaments. Often God is the shepherd and Israel is the flock. And then there's this wonderful scene, a wonderful Easter scene in John's gospel, in John 21, 15 through 17, where Jesus says to who? Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Feed my sheep. Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Feed my lambs. And so I think there's this connection here. This is where that authority of God as the shepherd of Israel, Jesus as the, you know, Jesus has pity on the flocks because they are like sheep with the flocks, the crowds, Freudian, because they are like sheep without a shepherd. And so this authority to govern God's sheep, to tend them, is passed on to leaders in the church. Literally in Greek, it says, tend the little flock of God, which I think is just so sweet. And it implies this attentive and compassionate care. And notice too, the second half of this verse, tend to the little flock of God that is in your charge. So whose flock is it? God's. That's right. That's right. The community, the leaders of the community are leading God's people, not their people. This isn't my church. This is God's church. This isn't my congregation. This is God's congregation. And so he says, elders, lead, tend the little flock of God. Tend them with compassionate, diligent care, remembering to whom they belong. Think maybe of the parable of the stewards, right? The stewards who are given charge over the master's possessions and to the master to whom they will have to give an account. The community belongs to God and is entrusted to us. So then he says, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you do. So remember back before the chunk we skipped, when we talked about hospitality as a Christian virtue, and that Peter says to do it without grumbling. So exercise oversight of those in your charge, not under compulsion, not like, well, I guess I have to because this is my job, like, these people are the cross I have to bear, but willingly, as God would have you do it, literally, according to the manner of God. According to God's own manner. So what this means is lead the community, and for us, be in community. Lead one another in a manner befitting. Care for one another the way you would care for something on loan to you from God. The people in front of you belong to God. Can you care for them the way you would something precious that God has given you to take care of? There's a little girl in our Sunday school, Caroline Leakey, and she's wild, but she's awesome. And I saw her at church, this was several months ago, and I said, Caroline, what a beautiful necklace. And she said, yes, it's my mommy's necklace. She gives it to me and lets me wear it to church. And when I get home, I give it back to her and she puts it in her room. She has this beautiful grown-up jewelry that her mom hands over to her, and she's so proud to wear it. That when she, and I think this is so key, we have so much to learn from children, when she tells me about it, she doesn't say, yes, doesn't it make me more beautiful? Aren't I so grown up with my, no, it's not about her. It's my mom's necklace that she lets me wear. This is God's church, which he lets me lead. These are God's people who he lets me be in relationship with. Can we care for each other the way Caroline cares for that necklace and then gently hand it back when the glory is revealed? Thank you for giving us this life and lending us these people. And now we offer them all back to you, knowing that God is the ultimate safekeeper of our inheritance. So how are we to be in community? Not under compulsion, but willingly. Not for sordid gain, but eagerly. Literally, not greedily, but eagerly. So this word, greedily, only appears in 1 Peter. Eagerly. The word that means eagerly. Only appears in 1 Peter. The adjective form also appears in 1 Timothy in describing the quality of deacons, and in Titus describing the quality of bishops. So what this tells me, putting on my historian hat and not my pastor hat, is that there was concern in the early church that those in power would become greedy, that those who were leading the church would lose sight of their of the flock they had been entrusted to them and would start doing it for their personal gain. Gee, I wonder where they got that idea, right? Like, good thing we don't have to worry about that anymore now that we're all enlightened. Yeah, sorry, it is greedily. The contrasting word is eagerly. So do not be greedy, but eager. This implies an eagerness not for money or power, but for service, being eager to serve one another. So I wonder, this is something that was very convicting to me, how we can be more eager about our work. And I don't just mean your secular vocation, your paid vocation, but the things that God has entrusted to you, the things that are on loan to us. How can we be more eager to serve them? Sometimes when you're just going through life, it can be hard to keep perspective. I joked, I think, to my good friend, Mother Jennifer, I said, like, being a parent is great, but figuring out what to feed them every day for 18 years feels like a lot. Like, That is a heavy ask. Like, every single day I have to figure this out? With no breaks. Like, that is not eagerness, right? It can be hard to keep perspective. But what a gift. What a joy to be, have each other on loan from God. How can we serve one another eagerly, even when it's hard? Even, it doesn't automatically make it easy or not burdensome. Of course not. Peter's all about suffering. But you can keep that perspective of having something glorious on loan. So there's this wonderful scene in, it's in the Screwtape Letters, but I'll kind of paraphrase because it's sort of confusing, where C.S. Lewis says, every Christian, this is paraphrasing, it's not a quote, every Christian, if Christ appeared before you and said, I need you to do something for me, just for 1 hour, would be overjoyed at the prospect of serving their Lord and God. What do you need from me? I would be delighted. I would be happy. You would be so sad that he's like, no, I need you for an hour and then I'm done with you. Right? No, Lord, please tell me, what do you want me to do? And he says how easily they forget that that is actually their situation every moment of every day. Every moment of every day, Christ is before you, calling you to serve him. Verse 3. Do not lord it over those in your charge, but be examples to the flock. This is similar to the sayings of Jesus in Mark 10:42, when he says, the Gentile leaders lord it over them, but the Son of Man came not to serve, no, not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So here's that connection to service. The Gentile leaders lord it over them. You have to serve me because I'm the king. But the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve by giving up his life. When he says, be an example to the flock, the word here, an example, is typoi, and it means a copy. Give them something to copy. Now, does this sound similar to something else we've studied in 1 Peter? This is the second time a copy has come up. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving an example that you should follow in his footsteps. The example that we should follow is the example of Christ. And so, leaders, you all, just the same way Peter has his authority through being a witness to the sufferings of Christ, the leaders have their authority insofar as they are following the copy of Christ. And I think Peter intentionally is linking this to this saying of Jesus, the Gentile leaders lord it over them. But the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life up as a ransom for many. So what does real leadership look like? It's not gaining wealth. It's not gaining power. It's service and giving up, to the point of even giving up his life. That's the example that all of us are copying. Then he says, and when the chief shepherd appears, you will win the crown of glory that never fades away. So see how this flows out of this idea of example. Though you do not see him, you love him. We're following Jesus' example even though we don't see him. We're tending the little flock, tending one another, caring for one another as best we can, as close to the image and the likeness of God as we can, and when he comes. So we do not see him, but we will. Don't lose sight of that. You will receive the crown of glory that never fades away. In the ancient world, a crown was given as an award for political, military, or athletic triumphs. And this is an imperishable crown. Often these crowns, you know this from Greek mythology, Greek literature, the laurel leaf crown that you see, you know, Caesar or whoever wearing, that fades away because one, it's a plant and they die, and two, because Caesar will die. But the crown of glory that will be received when the chief shepherd appears is one that doesn't fade away. So remember 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 9. Do not repay evil for evil or abuse for abuse, but on the contrary, well, that's not right. It must be 1 verse 3. Yes, verse 4. Okay, whew. I was typing very fast. By his great mercy, he has given us a new... Okay, so this is chapter 1. Verse 3 through 9. That's what I meant. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. By his great mercy, he has given us a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead and into an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you who are being protected by the power of God through faith, for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. So, if you follow in this example of Christ living humbly as a servant, giving up yourself, your own desires, your own ego for others, you will receive this imperishable crown of glory. So then on to verse 5. In the same way, you who are younger must accept the authority of the elders, and all of you must clothe yourselves with humility in your dealings with one another, for God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. So notice this in the beginning of verse 5. In the same way, you who are younger must accept the authority, literally, be subject to. This is just another one of those household codes, which shouldn't even be called household codes, they're community codes, right? In fact, some scholars, I don't think this, but some scholars think that this is from, that this actually is like a copy-paste error in the ancient church, and that this really belongs back in chapter 2, with the wives, be subject to your husbands, and all of that. So you who are younger, be subject to. I think, okay, it's not, remember that from chapter 2, all of the household codes have to do with what? Not servile obedience, but respect that comes from, this is so key, consciousness of God. Even when someone's treating you unfairly, are you conscious of God or are you caught up in your anger toward them? Are you operating this way or this way? The strength of one in a subject position comes from knowing where they actually stand before God. And so he says here, younger men, be subject to the elders. It's unclear who exactly these younger men are. It is likely, because he's addressing elders, it is likely that it is those young men who are sort of in training for leadership in the church. The next generation of leaders basically learn from those who know more than you. Have reverence to the leaders of the church. This is like that old Mark Twain quote, At 18, I thought my father was an idiot, and by 21, I was amazed at how much he had learned. That young men and women, Peter's talking to men, but it applies, trust me, to both, are confident that they know everything. And also remember, too, who is most likely to want to punch back when they're being... There's a reason that 19-year-olds fight all our wars, right? Because they think they're immortal, and they are easiest to get worked up. And so Peter is saying, young men, respect the authority of your elders. Copy them the way they are copying Christ. Can you let go of your anger? So the thing is, there's like a young man living in each of us. How dare she talk to me that way? Why don't these people respect me? We're all ready to go to war on our personal issues, on our little pet peeves, right? When we feel like our honor, like I will defend our honor. I will defend my own honor. They don't get to talk to us that way. But look to the example of those who are following the example of Christ. And what you might discover is that real strength is gentleness. Not servile, being a doormat, but that there is a strength in this calm, in this center, in this consciousness of God that actually might have you standing on firmer ground than if we listen to the angry young man in each of us. Then finally, he says, all of you must clothe yourselves with humility. So anyone I haven't addressed yet, slaves, women, young men, elders, husbands, anybody else, clothe yourselves with humility. Literally, the phrase is put on humbleness. Be dressed with humbleness as with a cloak. So notice too, acting with humility can help avoid the vices that were listed above. Not under compulsion, feeling put upon, not seeking sordid gain, greediness. You're only greedy when you feel like you deserve more than you have. If you're humble about what you have, grateful for what you have, there's no need for greed. That rhymed on accident. Do not lord it over those, right? This idea of like showing how great you are because you're in authority. That's the opposite of humility. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility. So I think humility... Remember, too, this is another C.S. Lewis thing, that humility is not strong men trying to believe they are weak or pretty women trying to believe they are plain, right? It's not feeling bad about yourself or certainly not denying reality. Humility, at its core, comes from consciousness of God. I did not create myself. I did not decide to wake up this morning. My next breath is given to me as gift. I can decide to clench or unclench my fist. I can't decide to make my heart keep pumping. The humility of seeing that the people given to us are the gift of God. And I think this is especially a challenge for the church today, all denominations. Cross denominations, humility about what we believe. So the reason people are in denominations is because we believe, and even in particular parishes, we think that the way we do things and the things we believe here are better than the other way. That's just a fact. That's like we, you know, like there are some things that I think we're right about. But I could be wrong. I have this argument with, not argument, I have this discussion with people about women's ordination. I believe that there is good theological and scriptural evidence to invite women into leadership positions in the church. Obviously. Talk about acting according to your conscience, right? I could be wrong. Now, what's interesting to me, now I'm going to be proud of how humble I am, so irony. What's interesting to me is that people who oppose women's ordination never have that same position. They never say, we don't believe that women are called to leadership in the church, but we could be wrong. Never, right? We do this with all sorts of things. The way church is organized, whether or not you have bishops, whether or not you baptize infants, how you approach the Holy Communion, whether pastors are elected or whatever other ways they're, called, right? We could be wrong about all of it. And this, I think, is the real grace of having diversity in the church, is that other people are there to remind us we don't have this all figured out. If we did, there would only be one denomination. Roman Catholics, by the way, think they do have it all figured out, and there is only one denomination. So Roman Catholics don't believe that we are the church. There is the church in Rome, and then there are what they call, I love this phrase, impaired Christian bodies. So they're like church-ish, but they're not the church. If they were the church, they would be Catholic, right? Roman Catholic. So I actually think, the lack of unity among Christians is a problem, and it stems from lack of humility. We don't have to all believe the same things. We just have to be open to the possibility that we don't have all the things figured out, that other people could be right. And here's the thing, at the end of the day, when all is revealed, we're all going to be wrong about a lot of stuff. But I also believe that so long as we are being, as we are working to discern in good faith, how do we live faithfully as a church? How do we interpret Scripture faithfully and live according to it? How do we continue to live as God's little flock, not seeking our own ends, not lording it over others, but with humility, that God actually doesn't judge us based on whether or not we get everything right, but whether or not we were faithfully following his copy, his example, to the best of our ability. God does not expect us to know everything he does. We actually have a word for that. It's called hubris. And it's the opposite of humility. But we do the best we can. Remember that image when we talked in 1 Peter 3, that word of following the copy. And that copy is not a mold, a type. It's a text that would be written out for a scholar to copy. So like when teaching a child to write, God expects us not to get it right. And so here's the irony. That needs to make us more humble, not less. We are following the copy as best we can. And so this, I think, here is how you can put this lesson about humility into your daily life, especially when dealing with other Christians. When we meet other Christians, especially those who are not in our immediate Christian community, especially those who disagree with us, our default assumption should be that they love Jesus too, and that they are also following as best they can. That is how we hold humility. It's not that we have to be relative and say, I actually don't believe anything. And nothing matters. You do you, I'll do me, it's fine. No. But to have the position that other Christians love Jesus too, and they are genuinely following him as best. It can be so easy to say, I do this about a lot of contemporary worship music, which is I like hymns. If it wasn't written more than 100 years ago, I'm not really interested in what it is. And so I have said things before like, okay, so I was at a wedding recently for a friend who goes to this big, you know, very, what my dad would call praise music, which is itself a dated term, big non-denominational church. And during her wedding, they were like singing these hymns that everyone knew except for me. And it's like hands in the air, full, you know, and I went to a Nazarene college. Like, I get it. I remember that world. And I said to Josh afterwards, like, that music now seems to me to just be emotionally manipulative. Which on the one hand, maybe. And on the other hand, maybe these people love Jesus too, right? Just because it's not my preference doesn't mean that their worship is bad and mine is good, right? Maybe they love Jesus too. Maybe they love Jesus more and better than I do. Humility. Clothe yourselves with humility. Then he quotes here from the Septuagint version of Proverbs 3:34. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Remember that grace and gift are the same word in Greek. The grace we have received, the gift we have received, is like Caroline's necklace on loan from her mom. We are the gift that we receive from each other and that we give to each other. So be humble. What an awesome thing to be called into the body of Jesus Christ. What an awesome thing to have an image of the living God standing in front of you, to have been given this little flock to be a member of and to help lead. What an awesome privilege, this gift, this grace from God. So verse 6 and 7 are going to start summarizing the major themes of the letter. So, ooh, we can do this. Okay, this is the perfect place. Like I said, it's the perfect place to end. That's why it's at the end. Verse 6, humble yourselves. Oh, well, in case you thought we were moving off the topic of humility, we are not. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that he may exalt you in due time. So as you've seen, humility is a major theme of this letter. And there's this fascinating phrase here, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. Remember the connotation to this previous passage. Clothe yourselves in humility in your dealings with one another. Where do we stand before God? This is not to say, like, what is my status, right? Like, you know, like on airlines, when you're getting rewards points, and they say, like, oh, your status. So, like, when Joshua was traveling for business pre-pandemic, he was platinum status. And there was also gold status. And then there was like what I have, which I call peasant status, which is like you signed up for the program, but like you do not give us nearly enough money to get any perk. Like if you want a seatbelt, that'll be $12. Like, it's not that kind of status. The status of all of us before God is creature. As Raleigh, you know, my good friend Raleigh Langley says, he often ends his prayers or begins his prayers when he's praying for us with, God, we stand before you knowing that you are God, we are not, and that is very good news. All of us have the same status before God, creature, fallen, beloved, redeemed. So whatever we, this is the key source of humility, consciousness of God. Whatever we do in this life, you got promoted. Great, you're still a creature. You had 5 kids and your sister wasn't able to have any, you're still a creature. Obvious examples, bought a new car, live in a big house, you're still a creature, right? All of us have the same status before God. and being conscious of that, that he is God, we are not, that is good news. That is the root of this humility. And so here's this fascinating phrase, humble yourself, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, which sounds like squashed like a bug, right? This is sort of a scary phrase if we read it out of context. The mighty hand of God bearing down upon us. This phrase, the mighty hand of God, is used only here in the New Testament, but no Old Testament, no Jesus. It's all over the Old Testament. I started to write down the citations, but they were like so long that I didn't have time. So if you want to look up the mighty hand of God, I can email you the list. In the Old Testament, the phrase, the mighty hand of God, is always used to express God's protective power to those who are humble and in need. The mighty hand of God is not what crushes you, but what protects you. He keeps you, like, remember, like children catching fireflies, protected, hopefully they don't squish them, don't extend this metaphor too far. Protected in the mighty hand of God, held in his hand. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God because of his protective power. Now remember how powerful this must have seemed to a church that is suffering persecution. Christians in this time have no power socially. They have no power civically. They have no governmental power. This is a small, disorganized community that lets women and slaves be members. They're never going to conquer a nation like Rome. They don't have an army. They don't have any money. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. Remember, too, back to 1 Peter 1, verse 4, that you are the God who is protecting you, the inheritance kept safe by the God who protects you. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. Then he says, so that he may exalt you in due time. We already know what the due time is, when Christ returns. This word exalt, in our, some of you may have a different translation, it means to lift up. We think exalt as like you're lifted up on a pedestal, right? Like he has exalted you. But it just means to be lifted or raised. And anytime something is raised up in the New Testament, it relates to resurrection. That he may lift you up, that he may raise you up in due time on the last day. That is where this humility comes from. That God is the God who can raise the dead. That is the God we worship. And so whatever we accomplish in this life, this is Hard Fact Tuesday, we're all gonna die anyway. But what if the God we worship is the God who raises up his children on the last day? So here is an entire summary of the theology of 1 Peter. Humble yourself, which, remember, in Peter also has to do with this submitting to the authority. You can submit to the emperor. That is being humble. Go ahead, pay taxes. You can submit to others. You can be gracious, respectful, give in to their wishes sometimes. That's humility. That's what humility looks like when it's lived. See, if you say, oh, I feel really humble, but damn it, I'm going to get my own way. That's a little bit like saying, I love you, and pushing someone off a cliff, right? Like, your actions don't match your words. So this sense of being subject to one another is what humility looks like when it meets a living person. To serve one another with humility, not looking for other people to serve you, So humble yourself. Be subject to suffering with cheerfulness, gentleness, and patience. That is humility. Because it has to do with consciousness of God. Because God is coming to lift up the humble. Remember Mary in the Magnificat. He hath cast down the mighty from their seat and hath exalted the humble and meek. The promise of 1 Peter and the Magnificat and the whole New Testament is that the rules that the world has set up are going to be turned upside down. Because God sees what's really going on. And if you have consciousness of Him, you can see it too. And then you can start living differently. Because you don't have to play by those rules anymore. And that is being set free. Know the truth, and the truth will make you free. So we aren't held by those standards, by those rules, by the culture that says you can't get away with letting people talk to you like that. Sure I can. You're not the boss of me. Because I know who the real boss is. Verse 7 is one of the most famous and quoted verses in 1 Peter. Cast all your anxiety on Him because He cares for you. We can sometimes hear this as like, you know, if people say like, let go and let God, right? Which is a fine, that's a fine interpretation. But let's not miss the deeper resonance. This word anxiety is general in Greek. We, you know, pathologize everything, so we think of it as like generalized anxiety disorder. But in Greek and in the New Testament, it's anything that is afflicting you, that is burdening you. So what is this community, Peter's community, burdened by? The persecutions from those not in their community. The slander, the gossip, the belittling, the arguing. Cast, this word cast, it literally means like cast, to throw. Throw the things that are burdening you onto God. Forget letting go. Toss it, right? In prayer to God because He cares for you. The way to be humble before God, this also relates to humility. One of the ways to be humble before God is to throw your anxiety back on Him. Throw your burdens back on Him. I think this is an underrated form of humility. We worry about things, we are burdened by things because we think at some level we can solve them. That's actually ego. And not humble. To say, here, you know, it's like the granny throw in basketball. Like, here you go, God. I know you care. I know that you are God and I am not, and I cannot fix this. And Pastor Barbara time, you especially can't fix other people. We cannot change other people. It is utmost hubris to think, if I can just convince this person that my way is better, then they'll see the light. And it's so hard because the people we love do such dumb stuff all the time. And I have all the answers. I say this to Josh all the time. I'm like, why does no one listen to me? I have all the answers. Just listen to me. Go ahead and throw that back to God. This person who I cannot fix, he is not lost to you. I'm at my wit's end, but I can give him back to God. Now, I want to make sure I get this. Oh, so here's another way too. If we cast our anxiety on God, it's not just trying to fix other people. We also are not harmed by other people in the same way. We don't have to take the bait. We don't have to fight back. My mentor, Father Brian, one time told me, he was like, you know, Barbara, you don't have to show up to every fight you're invited to. You can cast your anxiety on God. Gosh, this person said something about me and it really wounded me. I have two options. I can lash back and try to hurt them as much as they hurt me. I can throw it back at them, my anger at them, or I can cast it upon God because he cares for me. Okay, we're going to go over, well, now I still have 2 minutes, and we might go over a little bit, but I apologize. But what are you going to do, fire me? It's the last day. Oops, wrong page. Okay. Anxiety melts away in the knowledge that God cares for you, that there is nothing this community or an individual is undergoing that is a surprise to God, and that he will take his hands off of and leave you alone. But notice this too, this is not the same as passivity. Verse 8, this is why we can't end at verse 7, sorry everybody. Verse 8, discipline yourselves, keep alert. Like a roaring lion, your adversary, the devil, prowls around looking for someone to devour. Literally, verse 8 that says, discipline yourselves, keep alert. In Greek, it comes off so much stronger. Be sober, be watchful. This is like the charge given to someone who is keeping guard over a castle. Be sober, be watchful. Don't be distracted, don't be frivolous. This is important stuff we're dealing with. Casting your anxiety on God isn't a, what you gonna do, right? No, no, we have a role to play. It's not the same thing as being, as giving up. Cast your anxiety on him while being focused and self-controlled, guided by what really matters. I feel like so often in life, we spend our time worrying about things that don't matter. What Peter offers us is this perspective. You have an eternal inheritance that is imperishable, and Christ is coming very soon. How would our lives look different if we really believed those things? If we really believed that we were members of Christ's body, that everyone in front of us was a member of Christ's body, or even those who are not in the body, a human being made in the image of God, someone on loan to us, and that Christ was coming back to do justice, which includes us giving an account. How did you spend the life I gave you? How did you tend to the flock that I gave you? Be sober, indeed. This is that Advent message. Stay alert. It's so easy. So much of the time, we move through our lives like we're sleepwalking. But what Peter is reminding us is that it's this beautiful gift that Scripture and the tradition gives us, guys. So much is out of your control. You can't control other people's behaviors. Cast them to God. But so much is in your control. Be sober. Be watchful. You can't control what happens to you, but you can always control how you respond. Why are you letting other people make your decisions for you? This is a thing in parenting. You never say to your child, at least by the books I've read, I'm an expert, you're making me angry. No, I decide when I'm angry. That's a toddler, right? Like, she doesn't even toilet train. Like, she can't make me angry. I decide when I'm angry. I'm the grown-up, right? We always have a choice in how we respond. And the choice, the freedom, comes from this consciousness of God. Now here, gosh, guys, Peter is so brilliant. Consciousness of God. This is on purpose. We've used consciousness to mean being aware. We've related it to the feeling of conscience, right? They're related. Consciousness is being awake. Are you awake to God? Or are you going through life sleepwalking? Are you awake to the reality of him moving in your life and in the people in front of you or are we daydreaming? Stay awake. Stay conscious of God.
Okay.